Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, the cost of gold-plated public sector pensions has ballooned, and the gulf with private pensions is widening. Is it time they were cut, or do we risk a race to the bottom? Also, why workers earning £52,000 will be worst hit by changes to salary sacrifice. Plus, is another retail giant about to bite the dust? What has gone so wrong at Argos? And can it ever return to its former glory? When will food prices come down? And what are the names most likely to win the premium bonds? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a message from our sponsors. Still wondering how the budget will affect your finances? Lisa Kaplan and her team at Charles Stanley Direct are here to help. The financial coaching service gives you clear, practical guidance with no jargon and no pressure. Book your free 15-minute call today at charles-stanley.co.uk/financial-coaching. Go on, get answers you can trust. Remember, investment involves risk. Now back to the show. A row is brewing about the cost of gold-plated public sector pensions. The total cost has ballooned to almost £6 trillion this year, leaving households on the hook for an average of just over £200,000 each. That's according to new analysis. It comes at a time when private sector workers face a raid on their retirement savings, with the Chancellor attacking salary sacrifice schemes used to build pension pots. The government disputes these figures, but pension experts say the gulf between public and private sector pensions is getting indisputably wider. So what can be done about it? Welcome to you both. Simon, firstly, just how good are public sector pensions compared to private?
Public sector pensions compared to private sector pensions are infinitely better. Well, they're not infinitely better, because you can't really be infinitely better than something. But the fact that I reached for that phrase explains how much better they are. The big difference is that, firstly, if you are in a public sector pension scheme, you are almost certainly in a defined benefit scheme. And this means that your employer guarantees to pay you a set income in retirement based on your earnings when you worked there. Now, most of these defined benefit schemes have shifted from what used to be known as final salary. You used to get a percentage of your final salary, so basically your salary on the day you left an organization, to career average. But even then, they are far more generous, but more importantly, guaranteed. When you compare them to a private sector pension, the vast majority of which are now defined contribution schemes, in which you pay some money in, your employer pays some money in, it goes into an investment pot, and the amount of retirement fund that you have ready to pay for your pension years depends on the investment performance between then and when you retire. And then when you retire, you have to decide how you're going to turn that pot into retirement income. It used to be that most people bought something called an annuity, which is a financial product that guarantees you an income for the rest of your life and can pay one to your surviving partner, potentially. But most people now keep their pension invested and draw on it. And keeping your pension invested, drawing on it at the right level to make it last for the rest of your life, and doing all of the complicated stuff that means that your pension lasts you and you get enough income, is actually quite difficult, and a task that we're laying on people that most people are ill-equipped to deal with. If you work in the public sector, you don't have to worry about this. So to give an example of a scheme, in many of them, what you do is you accrue your pension at a rate of 1/50th. So for every year that you work there, you accrue 1/50th of your salary. As I said, it's not final salary anymore. It tends to be done as a career average. But so say, for example, that you worked somewhere for 30 years. You did 30 years working in the public sector. Well, in that case, you would have accumulated 30/50ths, i.e. 60% of your average salary over the time that you have worked there. And for many people, that number is going to skew towards the higher end of the salary that they've earned over those years, rather than the lower end that they've earned over those years. And, you know, to put it in context, if you were to try and buy that same amount with a pension pot, private sector pension pot, defined contribution pension pot, it would, in most cases, cost you, you know, a very, very large amount of money. We're talking hundreds of thousands of pounds.
So how did we get to a stage where the cost is almost $6 trillion and this new analysis saying that it leaves households on the hook for an average of just over £200,000 each? That is quite a hefty figure.
It is. And firstly, as you noted, the Treasury disputes this figure, right? So it says it's more like $1.4 trillion, but it's a few trillion between friends. What is a few trillion between friends? This is based on some research by a man called Neil Record, who is a former Bank of England economist. Okay, so it's not just any old person, right? Someone who knows their onions. And this is the overall projected cost of current and future inflation-linked public sector pension payouts, right? So it's all the money we're paying people now, all the money we've promised to pay people in the future. And the great thing about defined benefit pensions is those promises are pretty cast iron, okay? Your employer has to go bust for them not to meet that promise. And if they do go bust, there is a lifeboat fund, the pension protection fund, which if you haven't retired yet, will replace 90% up to a certain level. But if you have retired, we'll guarantee 100% of your pension. Okay, so they're really good. Okay, there's a pretty good guarantee on there. So this is the estimated cost of all of this. And these are quite generous promises that have been made to people. And illustrating that is how much the employers put in as a contribution. So this is something that is slightly misleading to get your head round, in the sense that most of these pension schemes are what's known as unfunded. So the pension scheme itself doesn't have a pot of money that it then uses to pay the people who are retired and pay all, and then eventually pay all the people who are working now who are going to retire in the future. Instead, the contributions are paid to the government, and in return for that, current retirees' pensions are paid by the taxpayer. So, but there is a nominal kind of contribution amount that the employer makes, right? Or actually not nominal, it's a contribution amount the employer makes. And there is a contribution amount that the employee has to make in order to get that, in order to build up their benefits. But NHS workers currently receive 23.7% employer contributions into their pension. Teachers currently receive 28.6%. employer contributions into their pension. Now, the employees themselves also have to contribute, and that tends to be done on salary level. So at the lowest level in the NHS, you pay in 5.2%, and at the highest level, above £55,000, you pay in 12.5%. Now, 12.5% is a lot more than most people are paying into their private sector pensions. That is true. The auto-enrollment amounts are 5% from you, 3% from your employer. Many employers will pay more than that. They might match it, for example. But you'll also notice that the employer contributions are a hell of a lot more than in the private sector. The reason why this is controversial is because ultimately, because they are unfunded, they're not funding themselves, these pension schemes. Everyone as taxpayers is paying for these. Now, I actually am not on the side of being really anti-public sector pensions. I think people who work in public service, they deserve a good pension, right? But I think everybody deserves a good pension. And what I'm not in favor of is a race to the bottom where we hack away at public sector pensions and make them worse to the point where they're as bad as private sector pensions. What I am in favor of is making private sector pensions better. We used to have world-class private sector pensions in this country. And then with the demise of defined benefit schemes and companies and final salary schemes and companies, which was due to a number of mistakes made by different governments. One of them is blamed on Gordon Brown, but Margaret Thatcher didn't help by allowing companies to effectively spend their surpluses. I'm in favour of making private sector pensions better. What I'm not in favour of doing is keeping public sector pensions as a much, much, much better option that we are all paying for, including those of us working in the private sector, whilst making private sector pensions worse, which is what the government is currently doing and why this is in the news at the moment. Mm-hmm. Rachel Reeves in the budget staged an attack on salary sacrifice, which is a scheme that is used by many private sector workers to pay money into their pension. It helps them get more into their pension. It gives them a little leg up. It doesn't like totally hold pensions under the water. It's not going to sink private sector pensions, but it is going to lead to less going in. And she has been warned that there's a strong chance it may lead to employers being less generous with their contributions, which in the scenario where public sector pensions remain untouched by this, and we're all paying for them, doesn't feel particularly fair. And the important point is that most public sector pensions operate as a net pay scheme. And that means that those contributions that are being made by the employee comes out before tax, right? Mm-hmm. So they're already getting a similar benefit to salary sacrifice, which is why this is so controversial.
Helen, what can be done about it, though? Because there is no government, certainly no Labour government, that's going to say, do you know what? We're going to just scrap that. You have to stick all your own money into it. So that, like, public sector pensions, I can't imagine, are going to have a wholesale change anytime soon. And that figure is still pretty high. I mean, even if the Treasury is right and that figure that they've given is a quarter of what this guy Neil Record says, you're still talking about £50,000 per household. And Helen, at a time like now, you know, we'll get onto cost of living crisis in a minute, but that 50,000 could very well be put in people's own pension pots. So what's the solution here? If it's not a race to the bottom, how do you lift all ships, as it were?
You're right. It's so tricky, isn't it? And actually, as Simon said, the way that these schemes work, the public sector schemes, is essentially that the people who are working and paying in today are essentially funding the pensions of people who worked in the public sector who are now retired. So if you were to change that scheme, it leaves an instant funding problem. You know, if you were to say, I mean, as you said, it's unlikely to happen, but if you were to change public sector pensions to the kind of system that the private sector has, where you pay in and you have a pot, then how do you fund the pensions of public sector people who are already retired? So I don't even know how that would begin to work. It would be a huge cost. And it comes at a time as well when people, especially in the private sector, aren't saving enough for their retirement. So it's, you're right, this huge kind of gap is emerging, and that, you know, it's going to become incredibly difficult. I think, you know, people already aren't saving enough, and now the government's doing things like capping salary sacrifice, which is, you know, encouraging people to save into their pensions even less. And, you know, do we have this situation where there just becomes a bigger and bigger gulf between public and private sector pensions? I mean, the government ostensibly could tell employers that they have to pay more into their workers' pensions, but then that will lead to things like, you know, they'll lay off people, you know, companies will probably cut jobs. So all those sort of moves would have a sort of adverse effect probably in the end. I mean, I don't really know what the answer is. If you want people to pay more, then you make it more tax advantageous, but they're obviously sort of doing the opposite of that. So it does become extremely difficult.
Simon, what have some of the experts say? I'm sure there's plenty of think tanks that have been mooting some ideas about what we can do.
I mean, look, there's an option in which you just do the same thing that happened in the private sector. You say, right, from this point on, we're going to stop having defined benefit pensions in the public sector. The benefits that people have already accrued, they will be paid. But from this point on, you won't accrue new benefits, and any money that you pay in will now go into a defined contribution pot. Would seem very, very unfair to people, but that is what has happened to people in the private sector. It happened during my employment at my company. When I started, the Daily Mail had a defined benefit pension scheme, and then it became unaffordable and it had to stop it. And it has a defined contribution scheme instead, which is a generous one compared to auto enrollment. And that is a situation that played out at companies across the country. And we do have a two-tier pension system. The other option is that you allow people who are working in the public sector already to continue accruing their pensions under defined benefit schemes, but new starters don't get to join. You can't go back on the promises already made. And as Helen points out, we've already made them and we're already on the hook for those. So it's going to continue to be expensive quite a long time. But if you take someone, for example, who ends up with like a career average earnings, you know, £50,000, which is a lot of money, but bear in mind, inflation, etc. And if you're looking at someone midway through their public sector career, it's highly likely that that could be the case. If they worked for 30 years and got 60% of their average salary, that would be a £30,000 a year pension. That would put them on track for a moderate retirement, according to the Pensions UK benchmark figures that we love so much on the This Is Money podcast. They'll be able to afford a couple of holidays and some Sauvignon Blanc, maybe. For the equivalent pension pot you would need in the private sector to get your £30,000 a year income, you'd need £750,000.
Wow.
That is way bigger than most people's pension pots will ever be. It is also a figure that you may notice will tip you into inheritance tax in the future because the government also decided to pull pension pots into inheritance tax, which, you know, they said it's because rich people are using them to pass on wealth free of tax, which is only true for those people who died before the age of 75. After the age of 75, income tax was charged on beneficiaries anyway, and rarely is dying before 75 considered a win. But the point is like, actually, those people are just doing what they were told to do, starting saving when they started work, building up a pension pot that is at £750,000 only just going to get them a moderate retirement and is the equivalent of what middle higher-ish earner in the public sector would get. Now, obviously, those public sector pensions can't be inherited because they die with you. But the benefits do go to your spouse, and there are other benefits that come with them, better death in service benefits and things like that. But like I said, I don't think that we should have a race to the bottom and make public sector pensions worse. We might need to make them a bit less generous, but you're then making them worse anyway. But I do think that we should recognise that there is a two-tier system, and we should stop attacking private sector pensions and, you know, and pension pots, which is what has happened. And bear in mind the previous government, okay, it can't wash its hands of this. They were the government that over the years in power slashed the lifetime allowance down to the point where it caused so much problem that the NHS was creaking at the seams. They slashed the annual allowance. When Gordon Brown left as Chancellor, the lifetime allowance and annual allowance were way, way higher than they were when the Tories left power. And then I guess the other thing I would say is, like, if you do work in the public sector, for God's sake, definitely sign up to your pension scheme. I mean, there are loads of people working in the public sector who just do not realise how good their pension is. Me and Helen were talking about this yesterday, recounting close friends and family that we know who we have had conversations with, and we're like, no, your pension is really good. And they're like, oh, it's like, no, it's really amazing. I mean, I've got a friend who's a doctor, right? And he's like, yeah, but I have to pay a load of money into it. I'm like, yeah, but what you get in return is amazing. It's so much better than what we were at to dinner. I was like, it's so much better than I'll get, that he'll get. I'm like, this is a really good deal. And I also think that when we're talking about people's pay, we should probably be talking about their entire package. So when you talk about teachers' pay, when you talk about resident doctors' pay, you know, when you talk about their pay, we're not accounting for the fact of, you know, the pension contributions going into there, which all of a sudden starts to make people's pay look an awful lot more generous. And maybe we should do this with the private sector as well. And it's true, in the public sector, it's a lot more rigid. There are pay grades. It is harder to climb the ladder. But the median wage in the public sector, I believe, is still higher than the median wage in the private sector.
All right, then. I want to stick with salary sacrifice because there's a bit of research done by the pensions consultancy LCP, which took a look at who would be hit the hardest with the new rules announced in the budget, making obviously salary sacrifice less lucrative from 2029. And they found it was middle-income earners. So actually they could be paying more effectively than those who are earning even higher. And when you throw in the simultaneous freeze on income tax thresholds and the level at which graduates pay back student loans, they're saying those earners on salaries between 40 and 50 grand will be hit the hardest. Helen, there's a lot of maths in here. I'm famously not very good at maths, a lot of numbers, but how does that work?
So it does seem to be, as with many things at the minute, it's people in this all middle earning band who unfortunately are going to take the brunt of this. So as we know at the minute, people use salary sacrifice they essentially forego some money from their salary and put it into their pension instead. That reduces their salary on paper, which means they pay less national insurance and income tax, and the money also goes into their pension. So it's been a bit of a win-win. As you say, Rachel Reeves is now capping the amount they can do that with every year at £2,000. So that means that people are going to be paying more in national insurance. As you said, LCP have run these figures and they show that, yeah, middle earners will be hit more by this national insurance rise, and those earning more could actually pay less extra national insurance. The reason for this is that employees earning up to £50,270 a year, so that's the threshold for the higher rate tax band, pay the full rate of employee national insurance. And after that, on earnings above that amount, it drops to 2%. So that means that basic rate taxpayers pay 8% in national insurance contributions on any amount sacrificed above the £2,000 cap. And those earning over £50,270 will pay 2% on anything above that. So someone has a £40,000 salary, they sacrifice 5% of their income into a pension, that you don't pay any more in national insurance. But if they double their contributions, if they pay in 10%, they'll end up paying £160 more in national insurance. Now, the most affected are those who are earning £52,000 and making a 10% contribution into their pension. They'll end up paying £256 extra in national insurance. So you should say as well, this all comes in from 2029, so not for a few years yet. However, the kind of sting in this, so someone earning just £4,000 a year more than that, someone earning £56,000 a year and contributing the same amount will pay just £72 more in national insurance because of this sort of cliff edge where the contribution amount goes down. So someone earning even more than that, someone earning £100,000 a year and contributing 10% will only pay £160 more in national insurance. So the people in that kind of middle salary band are going to be hit worse by it, which is unfortunate. Again, people in that middle band are going to be, you know, £256 a year is not... not a huge amount, but it doesn't feel nice, does it? If you're, you know that someone earning double what you are and paying the same proportion into their pension is paying significantly less national insurance on it than you. Not particularly fair situation, I think some would say.
Simon, is salary sacrifice though? Is it still worth it, or should you just up your pension contributions because you're going to get taxed on it anyway? Do we need salary sacrifice beyond that £2,000?
It's beneficial to people and it's a good system and it works. And I tell you the other thing, the kicker on this, right, is the reason why salary sacrifice is so good for workers is because you automatically get your full tax relief. With people who get paid, who pay their pension contributions off from after-tax wages, what often happens is you automatically get your basic rate tax relief. So you'd get your 25% uplift to take you back to where you were before 20% tax was taken off. But then you have to claim the higher rate tax yourself, either through a tax return, filling in a form, writing to the tax man. And lots of people don't do that. Lots of people miss out on the extra tax relief. And that saves the government an awful lot of money. So that's one of the other reasons why the government doesn't like salary sacrifice. It is still worth it. If your worker's got a salary sacrifice scheme, use it. I mean, it makes sense to do it. You will still be able to salary sacrifice after this. It's just a cap on £2,000 on the national insurance benefits you can get. If people then don't salary sacrifice so much into their pension, their employers will have to pay more national insurance because they'll be paying them the money instead and it'll increase their costs. It's still possible to use salary sacrifice. Even when this comes in, bear in mind, it's not coming in until 2029. It still will still be possible to use salary sacrifice above the £2,000 cap. You just won't get the national insurance benefits. You can still use it to avoid the tax traps and things like this. But that's where this kicker comes in for the £52,000 people, right? If you earn about £50,000, you are getting an absolute pasting from the frozen thresholds in terms of income tax. I mean, everybody's getting an absolute pasting from it, but you're right at that point where you go from 20% to 40%. And so your pay rise is going to get hit by 40% when actually if that band was moving up with inflation, it should only get hit by 20%. And And it's going to be taking a big chunk out of it. So if you only get an inflation matching pay rise, actually, you're 20% worse off.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Blair Mgashi of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Blair, we've got a question here from a listener. I'm 40 with two children aged 10 and 8. I have a £300,000 pension pot and have £600,000 of equity in our home with my husband, who also has a similar sized pension. If something terrible happened and we both died, would our children face inheritance tax on our pensions?
That's a very good question. Look, under current UK rules, you know, your pension is not part of your estate for IHT purposes. So normally your children would not pay IHT on those pots. So £300,000 from the wife and £300,000 from the husband, if both of you died, theoretically. However, following last year's budget, there is a major change coming. And from, you know, April 2027, pensions will essentially be part of the estate for IHT calculations. So in the example just now, currently you're fine. But when this change happens, it's a slightly different picture. Because if you calculate your pension pots plus the home, we're looking at some IHT being payable around £200,000 if we look at the nil rate band and the resident real estate band that you both would have in this calculation. So in a nice long-winded way, as things stand right now, your pensions are outside of your estate, but in 2027 that will change and can possibly impact you. So now it's more important than ever to kind of review your estate plan, make sure that, you know, you've completed nominations and expression of wish forms on the pensions, and, you know, seeking some advice to mitigate IHT and strategies behind that become more valuable.
Blair, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Ah, Christmas, a time for mince pies, slayed on repeat, and nostalgia. And what it invokes more memories at this time of year than the Argos catalogue. I mean, it wouldn't invoke memories because it's gone. I mean, maybe Quality Streets as well. But alas, while the chocolates remain a festive staple, the catalogue is but a relic of bygone pre-internet era. The question is Argos about to follow suit? The retail giant's most recent full-year results showed it had slumped to a loss, while it has also slashed thousands of jobs. Who remembers the Argos catalogue, though? Wasn't it? It was a staple of Christmas.
Big, big, big fan of the Argos catalogue. Yeah. And actually, I think potentially missing a trick there. I mean, we had my niece and my nephews to stay the other weekend. We looked after them. My niece Lila is 6. And she arrived with the Smith's Toys catalogue. And she did a lot of reading of the Smith's Toys catalogue, reading and circling all of the things that she wanted. And then we spent a very enjoyable 45 minutes on the sofa one morning whilst I was having my coffee and toast. And Lila was taking me through the entire Smith's Toys catalogue, showing me every single thing
lucky
she had circled. Yeah. And we went from the first page to the last page.
Wow. And you're advocating a return for the Argos catalogue.
I'm just saying that, you know, it's really difficult getting kids to tell you what they want for Christmas, even though kids normally want a lot of stuff. And this was pretty helpful. Arguably, she's going to get more presents off the back of it and they're going to sell more toys. The revival of physical media is happening. Gen Z are buying albums. They are buying cassettes. They love photos, everything.
Yeah.
Give them a catalogue.
What do you know? What?
Catalog.
Look, I don't want to make, you know, 2 + 2 = 4 here, Helen, but look, no Argos catalogue, bad figures, job losses. I mean,
I do think to an extent, you're right. You know, I don't know how much it cost them to print out those hundreds of thousands, probably millions of catalogues. You know, I remember, do you remember like just before Christmas, you would go, or a while before Christmas, you'd go to like your local Argos and they were outside the store.
Yeah.
They would have like a pallet full of catalogues. And you'd just be able to take one then, or like a huge wooden pallet full of thousands of catalogues, and people would just be like, yeah, everyone would grab one. It was such an institution, wasn't it? I think, you know, it hugely nostalgic. And my mum used to work in Argos as a Christmas job, right, when I was a kid. Like every Christmas she'd go and do like a couple of months shifts in Argos. And it was honestly insane. Like people would try and bribe her to like put the best toys by for them. So like my friends' moms would be like, whatever the big toy was that Christmas, like, you know, I don't know. They'd be like, oh, you know, remember those like bouncy balls, those like bouncy balls that used to stand on little girls? I remember one year it was those. And all everyone in my school was like, can you just, I know you work in Argos, can you like leave one behind for me and I'll come and buy it? And I was like, no, like that's against the Argos. But Argos was huge. It was, you know, it was where you went to do your Christmas shopping because it had everything. And it still has everything. But I think the issue is probably, I mean, Argos is kind of like a Amazon in real life, pretty much, isn't it? Like it has everything that you want. I mean, not to the ludicrous extent that Amazon has, but it's the same concept. You know, you go to one shop, it has most things that you might need in a big sort of warehouse situation. And I think over the years, Argos decided that it wanted to be more like a bit of an Amazon. So they stopped the catalogue. In 2012, it announced plans to reinvent itself as a digital retailer. And then obviously it was sold to Sainsbury's in 2016, which meant that the stores are now inside Sainsbury's supermarkets. So it's kind of moving away from this physical retail presence on the high street, which is obviously to save money, you know, expensive rent, staffing, that kind of thing. And I think Argos, it could be this sort of big online business. But I do think that seems to have backfired. I get that shops can't just keep open endless stores like on the off chance that some customers might wander in. But I think having like a presence is still important. I mean, I don't know if people would kind of just pop into Argos on the, you know, if they're just browsing the shops. It's not, you can't really window shop there. But it's, I do think having an Argos on your local high street, it's quicker than ordering something online. And I think that convenience of just popping in, getting what you need, like I do think that's something that people actually still want, especially, you know, if you've got something big you need to buy. Like I recently was buying a few bits of furniture from Habitat, which is now part of Argos. And, you know, much easier to just go there, pick it up, take it home than pay X amount for it to be delivered to your house, you know, wait for a few days for it. I do think there's situations where Argos actually is still handy. But then if you take away the stores and, you know, your Argos is in a little corner of your Sainsbury's, it's not really sort of front of mind. I think maybe people have just sort of forgotten about it.
Well, the front of mind is really key, especially when it comes to the catalogue, because that's it. Why would you go to Argos? Why would you go to Argos? You don't see it, except if you go to a big Sainsbury's, not every Sainsbury's. Simon, is this, I mean, Helen made some really interesting points there. And the one that I'm landing on is the Amazon, wanting to try and be like an Amazon. The reality is we live in an Amazon world, an Amazon retail world. Can any company compete with that? Is this symptomatic of a wider retail problem? Or actually, is this something that is more unique to Argos? Because I thought that Sainsbury's tie-up was supposed to reinvigorate, save Argos.
Well, I mean, you can compete with Amazon if you're Temu.
Oh, don't.
And the quality of stuff on Amazon has got a bit worse, actually. So, you know, my father-in-law, who regularly shops on both, says basically you might as well just order from Temu.
Oh, wow. Race to the bottom.
Yeah, for some stuff. And he ordered the same thing from both of them and everything like that. But the point is, I think Argos has massively missed a trick. In fact, if you go back far enough in the This Is Money podcast archive, you will discover the episodes where we were talking about Argos being bought by Sainsbury's and why it was buying it. And the reason why Sainsbury's bought Argos, or one of the reasons, is because Argos had absolutely nailed click and collect. It's hard to remember now, but Argos absolutely had click and collect sorted. You could order something. You couldn't necessarily go get it straight away because it wasn't always in the shop, but you could probably get it the next day, right? And the ability to do that and go into a shop on the high street and get that thing, as Helen said, was invaluable, especially at the way things have changed. I mean, it's become unbelievably easy to get Amazon or somebody else to deliver something to your door almost instantly. But you know what's going to happen? Like someone's going to come round, play knockdown ginger when delivering it, randomly give it to someone else. You might not be in. It might be something that you don't want left on your doorstep, thrown over a fence, given to a random next door neighbor that you're never going to find out who it was, all that kind of stuff. You might actually want to go into the shop and get it. And that's convenient for people. And there was this idea that they would shift it into Sainsbury's and people would do it in Sainsbury's, but it's just shifted it out of town. It's shifted it out of mind. And if you went into Argos at Christmas, it was always busy. Mm. You know, and it did great business. And I think they forgot what their unique selling point was. They've then tried to make the website a bit more of a marketplace. A note to any retailer who is considering doing this, and a note to those who have already made this mistake. Do not try to turn your website into a marketplace where you are selling your own stuff and also random stuff from other people. Consumers do not like it. If consumers want to buy random stuff from loads of people, they will go to a small but increasingly popular website called Amazon, right? They're not going to come to you, and you can't compete with Amazon on that stuff. What they want from you is to buy something from your shop, right? Whether you deliver it or often because they want to go into your shop and get it, what they don't want to do is have to spend 20 minutes scrolling through endless amounts of stuff on sale with no obvious way of working out who's going to sell it to them or when they might get it, right? That's not why we're on your website. If we wanted to play that game, we could go to Amazon or Temu or someone else, okay? And that's a big mistake, the marketplace thing. And then also it's this unique selling point of being on the high street. It's like, look at Nationwide. We talked about this a few weeks ago. Nationwide is hugely benefiting from that promise to keep those branches open. As all the other banks shut them, Nationwide Building Society kept its branches open. It's now the last branch in town in loads of places. This has become a virtuous circle. It's picking up more customers. Those customers are more profitable. Customers are happy. People are rewarding them. Read the comments on the story, the exclusive story we had from Nationwide about it continuing its branch promise to 2030. They are literally 98% of hundreds of comments of people going, well done, Nationwide. Thank you, Nationwide. This is great. Other people could learn from it. So I would say, get yourself back on the high street. Support the high street. What do people say is makes somewhere a great place to be? A thriving high street. Argos, get yourself back on the high street. Get that catalogue back in people's hands.
Yeah.
We will come back to you.
Absolutely. And councils, sort out the parking so people can park in town.
Oh yeah, as well. Yeah.
Just throw that in while we're on the subject. Right, we're going to stick with shopping because it's been 4 years since we first started talking about the cost of living crisis. While inflation has fallen back, energy bills have eased somewhat. We are still feeling the pinch a fair amount at the supermarket checkouts. Why are food prices so high? And is there anything the government can actually do to help? Helen, and what's been happening to food prices over recent years?
Everyone knows that they've been going up because everyone sees it week in, week out. I think this is one of the most obvious indicators to normal people of inflation and of where things are. You know, for years we've been talking about, oh God, like £9 for a bottle of olive oil, like Lurpak's how much? Like these conversations have been going on, as you said, for 4 years or more. And I think people were thinking, you know, we've seen energy bills were obviously incredibly high, you know, when they soared sort of £4,000 a year. And they've come down. They're still expensive, don't get me wrong. Like, they're still much higher than average, but they're a lot better than they were. And I think people thought that the same thing would happen to the price of a supermarket shop, but it hasn't. So it's still far outpacing inflation, even though inflation has been coming down. So October, the headline rate was 3.6%. And most other areas of spending in inflation is falling as well. But for food and non-alcoholic beverages in October, it increased by 4 percentage points. So it went up to 4.9%. So really, really stickily high this sort of food inflation is. And it's across all kind of things. So driven by increases in bread, cereals, meat, fish, vegetables, sugar, jam, honey, you know, real sort of staples that you can't really get around buying. And so why is this? In essence, I think it's because companies that produce food, farmers, are affected by all of the other sort of inflationary pressures that we have. So obviously their energy costs went up when energy prices spiked. And unlike domestic customers, they don't have a price cap. So they were subject to these huge, huge prices that are still kind of stinging from. Also, changes to minimum wage, to employee national insurance. Obviously, factories, farmers are affected by all those things as well. They're putting their costs up. And, you know, supermarkets for a while have been trying to, it sounds insane because shops are so expensive, but they've been kind of trying to limit, not pass on all these increases to consumers because they want to keep people shopping with them. And, you know, they want to sort of stay competitive with other retailers. But I think they're now saying we've had to put up our prices because it's just not sustainable to kind of keep them artificially low. People say, oh, the supermarkets are kind of ripping off, but actually their margins aren't that high. I think their margins are between 1-3%, which compared to other things you buy isn't a lot. So yeah, food has been really expensive for a long time, in summary.
It's been a wild time. I mean, who can forget security tags on packs of Lurpak, as you said there, Helen. Simon, Helen mentioned there are lots of reasons why this might be the case, but I don't want to point the finger anywhere. But there was speculation that, you know, some brands maybe might be sort of taking advantage of these sort of cost of living noises. So they rose prices anyway. Is there an element of that going on? And the reason I'm asking you that is because you think about energy sector and you think, well, it's got a regulator. Yeah, I don't think supermarkets have a regulator. Do they need one? I know that the Chancellor said in the budget that she wants to make the cost of living a big priority, but of course, no measures in there to ease the cost of our grocery shop. So, you know, what can they do?
Greedflation is what you're referring to.
Yes, that's the one.
Greedflation, that's what we termed it. This was back in the kind of peak of the cost of living crisis and just after it, actually. And it was a lot of brands, big name brands. So if you're buying branded stuff, people noticed the cost of that going up hugely and well above inflation. Now, the companies involved denied that they were doing this. But the pricing seemed to indicate that they might be taking advantage of basically of their defensive position as brands with moats, Warren Buffett style moats, where basically people will continue to buy their product. It's considered unique. There are many people for whom Heinz ketchup is the only ketchup that they will buy. I will admit, I was one of those people. For almost all of my adult food buying life, the only ketchup I would buy was Heinz ketchup. And I stopped buying it just after that kind of greedflation era because I was just like, I went in one day and I was like, I am not paying that when I can buy that supermarket own brand ketchup for a third of the price. And you know what? If you find a decent supermarket own brand ketchup, it's pretty good. So yeah, there was this greedflation thing. Now, producers will tell you that energy prices, etc., you know, huge rise in energy prices. If you look at a UK producer, for example, so let's ignore the big global brands. But if you look at a UK producer, they have got huge rise in energy prices, and energy costs more in this country than most other comparable countries. Large rise in wages, large rise in the cost of employing people due to the national insurance hike, extra costs due to Brexit, and, you know, extra kind of regulatory costs that have been introduced to them. So they have seen a substantial increase in their costs. And when you add all of this together, then it adds up to a lot. But then you're also seeing inflation coming from farms, from the raw ingredients of our food. For example, even vegetables. Climate change has led to a number of extremely sketchy years of weather. You know, very long periods of dry, followed by very long periods of wet, followed by very long periods of dry. And it's causing havoc with farmers. My brother-in-law is a vegetable farmer. He's constantly bemoaning the weather, you know, and not to come all Clarkson's farm on this, but it does matter. It does make a difference. And it really didn't help farmers when the decision the government made was to hit them for inheritance tax after the worst harvest in memory, basically. And this feeds through also, you know, grain prices feeds through to the cost of meat as well. Beef and veal inflation hit 27% in October. 27%. The cost of mince, beef mince, is up something mad, like 30-something%, causing people to shift to pork mince, it is, or buy less of it and use smaller packs and things like that. And yeah, okay, you can make different choices, but ultimately what this means is you're having to make different choices And it's making everybody feel poorer. And as Helen said, the price of your shop and the stuff that goes in your basket is something that you really notice. Often you don't notice it for a long time until you really do notice it. And then you really, really do notice it.
Is the pain going to be over anytime soon? I mean, this is the problem with inflation. Prices go up. If inflation slows, it doesn't mean the prices aren't still going. I mean, still going up. And it's not like they go, oh, right, well, inflation's not really high anymore. We'll just bring down the prices. They stay there and then they just build on that price. So is there hope? Is there a light at the end of the food tunnel?
Bloody well hope so, because I really like steak. No, I mean, there is potentially. Food prices aren't necessarily one of those things where it always gets more expensive. You do see prices spike and then come down. It does happen. Some of those costs, I think, are going to be there forever and they're not going to get cheaper. But I think that some of the things will potentially, come down in price. The pendulum does swing the other way, but probably not going back to where they were, which is bad news for people like me who quite fancy a steak for their dinner.
Finally, premium bond winners. They might be random, but there is one elite group, Helen, that has won a top prize more than anyone else. Who is this elite group?
So this elite group, Georgie, are people with the name David.
Right.
With the name Susan, John, Michael and Peter.
Right. So we all head down to change our names by deed poll then.
Exactly. And that will definitely work.
Brilliant.
So, yeah, crack on. Change your name to David, John, Peter, Frost.
I noticed there that Helen did quite well.
Unfortunate. The top 100. Yeah, so bad Helen's luck, Simon. Up there.
No, yeah. But I do find myself compelled to sort of search the list for Jennifer, Alison, Philippa, Sue, Deborah and Annabelle too.
Did they make it? But what is interesting about this list though, Helen, can I say this? They're quite, some of them are quite older names.
Yes, exactly. And Helen included. No, it's fine. I always say this to my mom. Well, what were you doing? Anyway, it's fine. I'm over it. Yes, you're right. So this is some exclusive data that NSNI has dug into for us. And they've looked at the names of people that are most likely to win premium bonds. Do go and look at this story on the website. You can search through the whole list by year and see the full rundown of the names that are most likely to win. You're right. I mean, obviously there is a large element of this that is, these are the people that are perhaps more likely to own premium bonds, perhaps older people, although I do think younger people are actually increasingly kind of looking at premium. Even some of the younger people in our office are, I mean, maybe we're a bit biased being sort of financial journalists, but I do think there's maybe a sort of wider age spread than you might think in premium bonds. But yes, obviously there is an element of this that is, are these just the people who are most likely to own premium bonds? But, it's a bit of fun. See if your name's on there. It's premium bonds are a fun product, aren't they? Have a look at our fun little list.
It all becomes clear now why Lee's had such bad luck, Simon.
There ain't no Lee on there.
Exactly.
There ain't no Georgina either.
I count George, though. I think that's totally
really.
Legit. I'm 53.
That's men called George, if I'm going to be entirely honest. Unlikely to be that many of them are women. Simon's on there, 45.
Is it? I missed it.
Yeah, Simon's on there. But it's quite an old name. When I was at school, we had a lot of Simons in my year. Now there's hardly any babies called Simon.
Oh, well.
I was in the Simon boom. They're all called Noah now. When we're recording this podcast, in about 35 years' time, we'll look at that list. I tell you, Noah's going to be massively featuring.
Yeah. Oscar as well. That's going to be up there. All right, then. Simon's stat of the week.
Okay. My stat of the week. My stat of the week is related to something that I said earlier. And I thought I should probably look up what the actual answer is. Is the median salary higher in the public sector or the private sector? The median salary, which is the one that if you put everybody in a line and you chose the person in the middle and is generally considered to be a better representation than the mean average, the median salary in the public sector is £39,943. The median salary in the private sector is 32,376. That is from the most recent ONS figures. So the median salary in the public sector is well ahead of the private sector. And interestingly, if you look at the percentiles, right, there's comparisons of the percentiles here. People in the public sector, the median person in the public sector, is better paid all the way up the percentiles until you get to the 75th percentile, at which point public sector £48,018, private sector £49,192. And from that point on, private sector is better paid. But all the way up to that 75th percentile, the public sector is better paid.
There was a lot of stats in there, Simon.
But it was a good one, though.
It was good, it was good. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Simon. Right, that is it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
Email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Tell us what you think. Tell us how we could fix pensions. Also, send us your questions for Steve Webb. Pension questions for Steve Webb. He's keen to get them. We will be answering some sent in by podcast listeners. And come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read your comments.
Thank you very much, Simon. Thank you, Helen. And thank you for listening. If you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.